You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, new restrictions go into effect as leaders around the world sound the alarm over Omicron. That and all the biggest headlines from overseas on the weekly news roundup. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a warning to listeners, this conversation is about mental health and will include some discussion of mental illness and suicide. The U.S. Surgeon General released a report last week warning about a crisis in youth mental health. In 2019, a third of high school students reported persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness, according to the report. That's a jump of 40% from 10 years earlier. And the pandemic has brought new stresses with transitions to and from remote learning, coupled with the uncertainty surrounding COVID-19. We're taking a closer look now at the factors driving this crisis in youth mental health and what parents, caregivers, and loved ones need to know. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a young person struggling with mental health concerns yourself, or are you seeing that among your friends? Have you noticed stress and anxiety rising in young people in your family or community? What effects have you seen the pandemic have on mental health for young people in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Anna Moffitt is Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, Dane County. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
And Dr. Ryan Herring is a professor and director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He directs the BRAVE Research Center, which studies the brain's role in resilience and vulnerability among youth following traumatic events. Dr. Herring, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, Dr. Herring, a big picture, we heard this warning call, really, from the Surgeon General here. What kind of things are we seeing in the run-up to the pandemic and since the pandemic started when it comes to trends in youth mental health?
Yeah, as you pointed out in the intro, there were already significant increases in youth mental health problems, even before the pandemic, such as increases in depression, anxiety, even suicide rates. And unfortunately, the pandemic has really exacerbated all of those things. So we're continuing to see even further increases in anxiety and depression, suicide as well, particularly in girls, increases in emergency department visits. And there's really just a tremendous need for mental health services for youth. So there's a lot of stressful factors, not just the pandemic, but other factors, racism and discrimination that are really taking a toll on some of our most vulnerable youth.
Anna, can you talk some more about the stresses you're hearing about from young people over this last couple of years?
Sure. Well, you know, I think one of the biggest stressors is going from being in all remote learning right back into full-time in-person learning. I know it's important for people to stay connected and be in person, but I think it's been a tough transition for our youth to go through such a traumatic time and not really have a space to process that before they're kind of being put back with the same expectations of 2 years prior and not really taking into account the toll the pandemic has taken on their mental health.
Dr. Herring, some people point towards social media is, if not the cause, then an accelerant of these mental health concerns. What role do you see social media playing in this?
I think that's a really good point. The way it's accelerated and catalyzed a lot of the mental health problems for youth is really problematic, and it's being increasingly recognized that it's contributing to anxiety. The recent reports about Instagram contributing to eating disordered behavior and distortions in body image in girls. There's a lot of concern to be had around social media use. I will point out that, and many teens will tell you this too, social media does also have its advantages. So it has been a way for youth to stay connected during the pandemic, particularly when they were in lockdown at home. So I don't want to categorize it as an all bad thing. I think it's really, it's a technology and it's how it's used. So I think having that conversation and making youth and families aware of that is important.
Anna, can you talk about the role of uncertainty during the pandemic? It's one thing to have an immediate traumatic event, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but just sort of the ongoing uncertainty about the future. How is that affecting kids?
It does have a negative impact on kids. kids, especially, it has a negative impact on everybody. As human beings, we do cherish our routines, and that is something that helps keep our mental wellness and stability. So having, you know, these disruptions time and time again can be really destabilizing for kids and adults. And so we do see that. And, you know, I think there's layers of uncertainty, and depending on demographic groups, you're going to see certain demographic groups facing far more uncertainties and instability than other groups. And so really being intentional about where we're putting our support as far as mental health supports, and making sure we are supporting those that are going to have the greatest level of need.
We are talking about youth and mental health after a Surgeon General alert that there is a crisis in mental health among young people in this country. Anna Moffitt is with us from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, Dane County, and Dr. Ryan Herringa from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Donna is with us in Brookfield. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. There's no doubt that the pandemic has caused a lot of havoc among our teens. My question is that historically, kids have gone through other periods of tough times. For instance, kids who survived the Holocaust, or kids who have survived, civil wars in their country, or horrible things like that. Is there data comparing those kind of historical events to what's happening now? And if our kids aren't faring as well, why might that be, and what can be done?
Donna, thanks for the call. I'll throw that one to you, Dr. Herringa.
That's a really great question, Donna. I don't know if we have all the answers. In fact, I'm sure we don't have all the answers on that yet. I'm not aware of research directly comparing the two and outcomes. And of course, there's so many different factors, you know, the historical era, the people were in, the different countries, cultures involved. I do think maybe one thing you're hinting at is that kids are also capable of a great degree of resilience. And if we can build those structures and supports around them, and like Anna was talking about earlier, give support to particularly those families who are particularly in need, I think that can go a long way. Another aspect of this is to what degree the family life and family structure has been disrupted. You know, we talk about the problems of youth mental illness, but this is really COVID in particular has had effects on the entire family and on communities. And I think if we can really support caregivers, parents, and communities, that will have a tremendous impact on teens, on children, for helping them to not only survive and cope, but ideally even to come through this with resilience and even stronger.
Thanks for that call, Donna, at 800-642-1234. Anna, on that issue of support, I wanted to ask, I assume there are maybe resources we don't have, but what kind of resources are there for people who, a young person experiencing a mental health concern, or their family members to reach out to?
Well, I would certainly encourage folks to reach out to a local NAMI affiliate or NAMI Wisconsin. We have affiliates all across the state. So I think our organization is a great starting point to help families and kids get connected with more local resources. And of course, if you have somebody struggling in crisis, using crisis lines, you know, using or texting 741 and text, you know, use a text crisis line. So just reaching out. There's a lot of variability across the state as far as services and supports. And we know within our rural areas, it's a big problem. But with that being said, there are supports out there. So I would really get familiar with what's in your community locally. I really encourage children and youth and family members and caregivers to be proactive. Even if nobody is struggling with a mental health condition at this point in time, find out what's available, because things can change quite rapidly. And it's good to be proactive and be prepared.
We're talking to Anna Moffitt with NAMI Dane County and Dr. Ryan Herringa, expert in youth psychiatry at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about a new report from the U.S. Surgeon General about a crisis in youth mental health, a crisis that started pre-pandemic, according to a lot of the data out there. The pandemic, of course, not helping matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's tough to talk about mental health in your family or your community? Have you found a good way to talk about it in your own family? Do you have a local resource you would point toward as something that helped maybe you or someone you know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about youth mental health. Anna Moffitt from NAMI Dane County stays with us, along with Dr. Ryan Herringa from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. We've got Jacob with us in Chippewa Falls. Jacob, hi. Are you there, Jacob? Bye. I think we've lost Jacob, but thanks for giving it a shot. Well, Dr. Herringa, I know you focus in your work in part on young people have been through a trauma of some sort, a traumatic situation, and trying to help build resilience. What kind of things do help foster that kind of resilience you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, there are a number of things that I think can help youth and families to help kids thrive and to get through really stressful and traumatic situations. Certainly one of the biggest factors is social support and making sure that youth have an opportunity to be in a supportive school, that the family has the resources they need. That may mean addressing things like housing and food insecurity and financial insecurity as well, which Congress certainly tried to do, at least at some level. There are also, I think, other factors such as peer support groups. Anna talked a lot too about, NAMI is an incredible organization with a lot of supports and guidance available. But really reaching out to sort of the natural supports that youth and families may have. Maybe that's a religious organization the family belongs to. You know, maybe it's a neighborhood community center. It could be a coach or a teacher, a school counselor. So I think really it's important to bring in those supports, and also for families to really have those conversations to the extent that they can, to check in with each other and see how everybody's doing. And the last thing I'll add is for caregivers, for families, to really not hesitate to get support for yourselves. It's caregiving, parenting is an incredibly hard job and has become so much harder during the pandemic. And so I'm hoping for parents, for caregivers, that the bar would be lowered to get themselves some help as well, to bring some compassion and being open to getting that help and guidance. We all need it.
And I wanted to ask about the role of peers in particular for that, say, a high school student who's worried about a friend based on in-person interaction or what they're seeing in social media. What kind of things can peers think about and be aware of to at least try to help?
I think peers are such an important piece, especially when we're talking about adolescents. And so really, if you have a friend who you think may be struggling based on stuff that you're seeing in social media or behaviors or conversations, is to really not be afraid to be upfront and just acknowledge what you're noticing about maybe their behaviors, their thoughts, or their feelings, and to let them know that you're concerned and that you want to help and that you will be there for them. I think just being open and honest and having that conversation. I would also too, as far as peers, if you have a friend and they disclose something like thinking about or planning to take their life, that would be a conversation that you would most definitely have to pass on to a trusted adult. And so it's important for peers to support each other, but it's also important to reach out to a trusted adult if you have significant concerns for your friend.
Let's go back to our callers. We've got Jacob back at Chippewa Falls. Jacob, I'm sorry. I think that was on our end, but I think we have you now. Hi, Jacob.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
So I'm just wondering when the cost of mental health starts to outweigh the cost of COVID. As far as I understand, currently the death rate of COVID is still less than 1%. And I don't know what the statistics are for suicide and, you know, significant mental health costs or costs associated with mental health. But I'm wondering, at what point do we say, hey, the cost of mental health and the issues that are being caused by COVID, and not that mental health is only caused by COVID, but I'm wondering how has it changed since the pandemic? And at what point do we, as a public health official, say, here, now this is a much bigger issue that we're causing or that we're intensifying compared to the risks associated with this pandemic that we're still apparently in?
Jacob, thanks for the call. Dr. Herring, it can be tough with 800,000 deaths. Those all have a mental health impact potentially on young people as well. How do you try to balance out mental health impacts of COVID measures versus the public health measures that we need?
Yeah, Jacob brings up a really good point that it's a tough balance to strike, right? The scale on which COVID is acting and the number of people dying, you know, takes obviously a tremendous toll on families. And, you know, for many youth, they've lost a caregiver or, you know, loved family member or a friend. And that's really, really hard for one's mental health. I think one area we've seen this really change this year in terms of really striking a balance between trying to mitigate and at least slow down the spread of COVID and protecting youth mental health is in the schools. And most schools are now operating back in person if they had been closed. And that's really based on increasing evidence that school closures and remote learning are really not good for kids. They're not good generally for kids' education. And we're finding out it's not good for kids' mental health to be remote and not interacting with peers in person. Certainly there are special cases for children who may have vulnerable immune systems or special learning needs where, you know, where different situations apply. But I think that's a really good example of where public health has struck a balance between trying to keep kids at school when at all possible, while certainly doing everything else that they can, including distancing and masking to try to minimize the spread of COVID.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Anna, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line talking about the cost of mental health care in some cases. It's easy to say, seek some kind of professional help. How are we doing when it comes to A, access to that kind of help, and B, the affordability of help people might need?
Well, that's a great question. And honestly, as far as access, I would argue that we're not doing a very good job. I mean, especially when we're looking at children and youth, only about 50% of children and youth with a diagnosis actually are accessing treatment. So that, you know, means one in two people aren't getting treatment. So we really need to explore why that's happening. Of course, cost, access to healthcare is a barrier for a lot of families, as well as wait times for getting services. So I think it's something that needs to be addressed more by, and I would even say by government levels, because we're talking about bigger systems. It's not an issue that can, you know, be resolved by different small groups working on it. It really is like a systemic issue that needs to be addressed. But yeah, I mean, I the numbers don't bear out well. And even looking at when someone is diagnosed, it's usually about 10 years until they're in treatment. And so really figuring out why that's happening, because we know the earlier we intervene and provide treatment, the greater outcomes, the better recovery journey that people will have, especially our children and youth.
Dr. Herring, looking to the future, are there things that make you hopeful that we can deal with this trend, this problem of youth mental health concerns, again, that started before the pandemic? Any bright spots that you see out there?
I do see some positive trends. I think the increasing emphasis and awareness, for one, on mental health problems and a willingness to talk about those is really a good sign. And, you know, part of the I think one of the questions underlying the rise of mental health problems is our youth simply more willing to talk about this, maybe than previous generations even. Social media, you know, we talked about the harms it can do. I think there's also a lot of potential there to do good in terms of helping youth feel connected with peers, connecting them with mental health services, and even being able to screen youth in a more automatic way, you know, giving pop-ups for crisis lines, for example, when they might post certain things. So I think there is promise there if we can do it right. I also think some of the increasing attempts at building in wellness practices and skills in the schools, I think can really do a lot of good. And these can be things like having peer support within the schools, doing or having meditation or mindfulness related classes, you know, building in exercise and nutrition and guidance about sleep. So I think there are a lot of things that we can do. I think, like Anna was saying, some of these need to be implemented at scale on a bigger level, and so may take action really from the state or federal government to really, really begin to move the needle.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to both of our guests, Anna Moffitt, Executive Director of NAMI Dane County, and Dr. Ryan Herringa, Professor and Director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. If you or someone you know is in a crisis, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Coming up Monday on Central Time, why do we humans dream? We'll get some of the different theories to explain that sleep mystery. That's Monday on Central Time. Coming up, out of concern over COVID-19, more millennials are starting to write their wills. We'll get some advice on how to do that at any age and take care of other estate planning related matters coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about holiday cookies on this week's edition of Food Friday. First, a lot of young adults are thinking about their own mortality these days. According to a report in the Wall Street Journal, the pandemic has a lot of younger people feeling uneasy about their future well-being, and as a result, more and more of them are writing their wills. Meanwhile, Caring.com says in 2019, 18% of 18 to 34-year-olds had a will. In 2021, that went up to 27%. And last year, the legal documents company LegalZoom said about a third of those under 35 who wrote a will said they did so because of COVID-19. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gotten your will or other estate-related planning in order during the pandemic because you were nervous or just because you had more time on your hands? For people younger, under 40, say, what was it like to write that will? What led you to go ahead with it? What questions do you have about wills, trusts, probate, or other related matters? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer Hannon is a member of the Estate Planning, Estate and Trust Administration Practice Group of Godfrey & Kahn. She also serves on the firm's management committee and is their managing partner. She focuses on estate planning, probate, and trust administration and other areas. Jen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have these reports of Wall Street Journal and some online platforms. Is this something you're seeing in your office lately? Maybe younger people than you used to asking about wills.
I would say yes, although I think a lot of the younger people are turning to the internet for some of their advice and drafting with respect to wills. That said, we have been incredibly busy the last 2 years, and some of that, of course, relates to people facing their own mortality, as well as, you know, the possible anticipated changes to tax laws in the coming year.
I'm guessing even before the pandemic, you would encourage people, maybe more people than have thought about it, to think about making a will or making other arrangements. Is that a good guess?
Absolutely.
What are some of the problems that can happen if people might not think about if they don't tackle these issues?
Well, the most prominent is that property ends up going to a place or a person you would not want it to otherwise go to. Wisconsin does have, like many states, all states, have laws regarding what happens to your property on death if you have no will. We call that intestacy. And if you die intestate without a will, the state says where your property goes. And that may be to typically your parents, if you have no children, if you have children to your children, if you have a spouse to a spouse, it just depends on the makeup of your family situation and the laws in that state. But many people don't have a nuclear family like they used to. And a lot of those laws are somewhat antiquated in terms of the line of descent.
I want to talk about some different situations and then how complicated we'd want to get into for a will. I'm thinking maybe of those people, millennials came up in the conversation with children, younger children. What kind of things do they definitely want to resolve if they're making a will?
Definitely determine who you want to have the physical custody of your children and be their guardian. That is the most important thing. And in most states, that designation can only be done in a will.
What happens then without that designation, should a parent pass on?
Then the court determines who will have the physical custody of your children. And it may not be the person you would have wanted to have them.
How complicated is it to do this? Is it enough just to, for that situation? Like, I want a will to make sure my kids go to this person or this person. Can we just do that with an online form? Do we need to sit down with lawyers? How complicated is this?
It doesn't have to be complicated. It can, though, become more complicated based on your personal situation. If your sole purpose in drafting a will is to just make sure you're designating people for your guardians and you don't have a complicated financial picture, then perhaps using an online resource would be very simple for you in the short term. If your assets are becoming more sophisticated, if you own a business, if you have any kind of strife in your family, perhaps then you should meet with a professional to figure out how best to address those issues.
Talking to Jennifer Hannon with Godfrey & Kahn, estate planning expert there. We're talking about wills and other elements of estate planning. Some reporting out there is showing a rising interest in that for younger age groups, millennials, and even younger. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you've made new arrangements in the last couple of years or you have questions about what kind of things you should be thinking about. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer, you mentioned family strife. And I imagine a lot of people want to avoid leaving behind difficult situations over money and other issues after they pass on. What kind of things can we do to make our survivors get along more harmoniously or as best we can?
I don't know if you can do anything to make them get along more harmoniously, but you certainly can take some of the guesswork about what you wanted to have happen and have the legal documents in place to make sure that what your wishes are followed. And some of that is certainly that's built in the will. The other thing you also want to make sure of, and that this is in light of COVID, is making sure that if you're incapacitated for a period of time, you have the right people making decisions for you. So healthcare powers of attorney, financial powers of attorney. When you don't have a clear plan in place, even if you have no difficult family relationships to contend with, those stressful situations may bring out something that wasn't there before or was under the surface, and individuals could start fighting over who's in charge. So if you clearly have documents in place that state who is in charge, you can kind of take all of that out and the stress of the family and the stress of the situation can dissipate.
I've been asking about wills so far. I know sometimes people think about trusts. I assume that's in more complicated financial situations. First of all, what is a trust as opposed to a will?
A trust is just a contract between the person who creates it and the person they're designating to be their trustee, which states what they want to have happen with their property, both during lifetime and at death. The primary purpose for a trust, when we're talking in the context of wills and estate planning, is to avoid probate. Probate is the court-supervised process of administering a will, and many people these days want to avoid that for privacy concerns and or, you know, to avoid additional costs associated with the estate administration process.
We're talking about estate planning, wills, trusts, probate, and more with Jennifer Hannon. She's a member of the Estate Planning, Estate, and Trust Administration Practice Group of the law firm Godfrey & Kahn in Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest about how all this stuff works, who needs to be thinking about it, what kind of issues we should focus on, maybe your experiences, if you've made the decision to make your first will ever over the last couple of years or take the time to revise it. What are some issues you've run into? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you had a bad experience, maybe in probate, if someone didn't leave well-detailed instructions? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about estate planning and wills. The Wall Street Journal had a story last week about how more and more millennials are writing their wills, in part out of concern about COVID-19. Jennifer Hannon is with us, member of the Estate Planning, Estate, and Trust Administration Practice Group of Godfrey & Kahn. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about wills, trusts, planning, and more. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can share an experience that you or maybe your family have had. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer, when it comes to probate, what kind of things do they look at if there's not a will or a trust in place, or do they just go with state law and it doesn't matter at that point?
Correct. If there's no will or trust agreement in place, the probate court will administer the deceased's estate pursuant to the laws of intestacy, which has that backup or default line of descent for your heirs. So again, if that's not something you'd want, perhaps you should have a will in place. The other thing I should point out is not everything goes through probate, which I'm sure many of the listeners understand here, but just in case those don't, things like life insurance and retirement accounts have beneficiary designations on them. And those assets don't go through your will. They go via your beneficiary designation that you have on file with your financial institution. So regardless of what your will says, if your beneficiary designation say something different, the beneficiary designation will trump the will.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Madison. Gail, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Gail?
Yeah, my question is, I can't get my father to write a will. He's turned over like medical power of attorney, financial power of attorney to me. The house is in my name and my sister and my brother's name. I would have access to his bank accounts. You know, he lets me know the account numbers and how much is in the accounts. But should he still have a will?
Gail, thanks for the question. Jennifer, I'm assuming you'd encourage her dad, yes, indeed, to have a will.
I would, only because I don't know exactly how the items that you're talking about are titled. If you told me that all of your dad's assets were titled jointly with you or with you and your sister or other siblings, then perhaps there would never be a probate to worry about, and therefore a will wouldn't become operative. But if he's just sharing information with you upon his death, you will not be an authorized account user. So it would be something that would have to go through the probate system. Now, if you're his only heir or whoever, maybe you and your sister are his only heirs, and he's not married and he doesn't have any other children and he wants all of his assets to go to you, then the laws in Wisconsin governing intestacy would get it there. But again, it just makes it a little bit more organized if you have those documents in place. And just frankly, a little easier for you as the heir to manage the process if you have those documents in place.
Gail, thanks for the call and good luck to your family. Brianna joins us now in Janesville. Brianna, hi.
Hi there. I was just wondering if she could tell me when is it appropriate to have a living will versus a standard will? And if there are any circumstances in which a living will is the better option?
A living will, Jennifer.
This is a common misconception. A living will can mean different things to different people. Oh. Some people refer to a living will meaning a trust, a living trust. A trust is that document we talked about earlier that can help you avoid probate. A living will actually is a healthcare document which states your specific wishes regarding healthcare in an end-of-life stage care situation. So assuming we're talking about trusts, so living trusts, there is no threshold in terms of when a trust would be desirable. Most of the time, it's governed by how private an individual wants to be with respect to their finances. Anything that goes through probate is subject to court review, and anything that's filed with the court can be received and viewed by anyone who wants to. And so when you go through the probate process, you have to, for instance, list all of the heirs, list all of the assets of the estate, list the values of all of those assets and who's going to receive all of those assets. Many people don't like that regardless of how large or small their estate is. So they would prefer to not have to go through that process and keep everything out of the public eye.
Thanks for the call, Brianna. And how about making that other meaning of living will, the one that's more commonly assumed, I think, about medical directives, end-of-life potential directives?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, there are two documents for healthcare instructions. One is a healthcare power of attorney, in which you designate an individual to make healthcare decisions for you if you're unable to do so yourself. And the other is a living will, sometimes called a declaration to physicians, in which you state specific wishes regarding three items. One, do you want life-sustaining procedures used if you're in a persistent vegetative state? Yes or no. Do you want feeding tubes used if you have a terminal illness? Yes or no. Or do you want feeding tubes used if you have a persistent vegetative state? Yes or no. So that's what a living will is here in Wisconsin. Very, very short and sweet, but it gets across those very specific wishes you may have regarding end-of-life care.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go to Linda next in La Crosse. Linda, hi.
Hi. My question is, if you have revocable trust, how difficult is it to switch it over to an irrevocable trust? How much is involved?
Linda, thanks for the call. Jen, can you start with what does it mean to be revocable versus irrevocable?
So revocable means you can revoke and amend it during your lifetime, change it as many times as you wish, the terms of it. An irrevocable trust means you can't revoke it or amend it. The short answer is you cannot convert a revocable trust to an irrevocable trust. That conversion just doesn't occur. Instead, you'd have to take assets out of a revocable trust and create a new trust that was irrevocable and gift them to that trust. That's pretty advanced estate and tax planning that some people do partake in, but usually those are for individuals who are concerned about a taxable estate, which is greater than $11.7 million.
Thanks a lot for the call. Hope that helps. Jen, in our last couple minutes, a lot of families will be getting together online or maybe in person for the holidays, and I've heard people encourage us to talk to family members about these issues. Not the most pleasant conversation always, but can you make the case that, yeah, get together as a family and figure out what you want to do?
So I can go either way on this. I think what's most important is people make a decision to do something and communicate it to their family. In working with families for the last 20 plus years, I think it is very difficult to convince a parent to do anything, especially the older they get. So while it's great if you have that kind of a relationship with your family to have these types of conversations, I think if you're trying to convince them to do something, convince them that it will make your lives a little easier. It may save everybody a little money on the back end. And it's important to have these conversations so that whatever their wishes are, they are complied with, versus children, of course, flailing and just trying to figure it out based on random conversations over the course of decades.
Jen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jennifer Hannon is a member of the Estate Planning, Estate and Trust Administration Practice Group of Godfrey & Kahn, the firm's managing partner. Talked to her about estate planning and how to get our wills, trusts, and other legal affairs in order, as reports are out there that more millennials especially are getting more interested during the pandemic in making those kinds of arrangements. The nearly 7,000 Afghan refugees living at Fort McCoy were introduced to an American holiday tradition last week. The Madison Ballet did four short performances of The Nutcracker for the families. WPR's Courtney Everett was there to capture the excitement.
Dozens of Afghan parents and children sit inside a warehouse. Their eyes are drawn to the sugar plum fairy gliding across the stage in front of them. Some are even capturing the beauty with their cell phones. The performance was Jonathan Solari's idea. He's the CEO of the Madison Ballet. The idea came together in just 1 month. The joy around him reminded him of his time helping refugees in Greece in 2015 and 2016.
I had seen the families who were in this transitional space and how much joy engagement with simple arts and crafts brought them.
Solari called a friend with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in Maryland and shared his idea. Then a collaboration was formed.
There's Department of Homeland Security, the Department of State, the Department of Defense, the Army, the Fort McCoy workers. It's been exceptional.
30-year-old Mushkan Karimi is one of the refugees amazed by the live performance.
What I seen here, it was more than what I accepted. That was really amazing.
Unfortunately, she watched the performance without her family.
No one is here with me. I'm alone. My family is in Afghanistan. It's been stressful since I came here.
Karimi has been at Fort McCoy for 3 months. Her cell phone broke while she was trying to navigate the chaos at the Kabul airport. It took her a while to hear whether her parents were okay.
Sometimes I'm thinking about it. I wish I never come.
The performance is a welcomed break for Karimi from her stressful situation. Some children living at the base never had seen dance before and even got to try it before the afternoon performance.
Okay, now we're going to try something different. We're going to go.
That's Madison Ballet instructor Juan Carlos de las Velas. He's teaching the children different ballet techniques, including twists and leaps. A few of Atikula Amadze's children beamed while they danced. He lives on the base with his wife and 7 children.
And every morning when we wake up, we appreciate that and we thank God that we are here safe and secure with our families. And there's not enough words that I can say that how grateful we are for that.
He and his family boarded a plane at the Kabul airport with about 380 other refugees. Now, he hopes to find work.
All I will try to find a job and send my kids to school. And obviously, I have to go to work to put food for my family on the table and whatever they need, I'll do for them.
His story, like so many other refugees, holds onto hope. Sisters Ariane and Layla Zafari understand what it means to leave Afghanistan in hopes of a better future. Ariane is a board member with the Madison Ballet and explains their father's family fled Afghanistan decades ago.
My dad had to walk on foot for weeks to get from Afghanistan to Pakistan.
12-year-old Layla is an angel in the Nutcracker and hopes that the performance is an inspiration to refugee families.
I'm happy that I get to perform for them, and it's like a sign to tell them to don't stop following your dreams.
Although the performance had to end, it was a short escape into dreamland for the families as they pursue new lives here. Courtney Everett, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Wisconsin professional baker about her favorite holiday cookie recipes and advice, and you can share your favorite cookies. In fact, you can do it right now. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us about your favorites. If you've already made them this year, share some pictures, or better yet, mail those cookies to Rob Ferret, care of Wisconsin Public Wait, what's that? Oh, I can't actually ask people to do that. Huh. Okay. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.